And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. It is estimated that 20 million people around the world suffer from schizophrenia. And this is a disorder that not only causes all kinds of suffering and disruption of people's lives, but it is also a disorder that, as yet, is not all that well understood. In fact, my morning show guest today, Dr. Stephen Lesk, says in his book, Footprints of Schizophrenia, this illness has yet to be clearly defined after centuries of debate. Elsewhere in his book, he calls it an ill-defined infirmity. Dr. Lesk's book is actually a dramatic step towards perhaps understanding schizophrenia, unlocking the mystery of just what is behind this widespread and varied disorder. I mean, a disorder that manifests itself in a lot of different ways. Dr. Stephen Lesk is a psychiatrist who has worked with all kinds of people dealing with schizophrenia and other mental illnesses for nearly 40 years. His work has included a stint at the psychiatric hospital for the Brooklyn VA hospital. And he also taught on the faculty of their affiliated medical school. His book is titled Footprints of Schizophrenia, The Evolutionary Roots of Mental Illness. And this is a book which, to an extraordinary extent, takes a long view of human development and perhaps some secrets from our distant past that help us understand why schizophrenia occurs in the lives of so many people. And I'm pleased that Dr. Lesk can join me for the next few minutes to talk about his new book and this intriguing theory which it presents. Dr. Stephen Lesk, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thanks so much. I'm excited to be here and anxious to start explaining what the theory really is.
Tell us, first of all, if you would, what prompted you way back when to enter the field of psychiatry? What in particular drew you to this field?
Well, I was always interested in what made the mind tick. And I did a bachelor's in psychology, a master's in psychology, I got a medical degree. And I thought it just made perfect sense to go into psychiatry. It's always been something that I studied and researched and wondered about and found fascinating. And I've been lucky over my 40-year career to be constantly stimulated and interested in the work that I'm doing and the patients that I see. And as I put in my book, my best teachers are my patients. They're the ones who educated me about what was really going on in their minds.
In general, what would you say have been the most dramatic differences or changes in your field of psychiatry over these last nearly four decades that you have been practicing? What would be some of the most important ways in which the discipline has undergone transformation for good or for ill?
Well, before the 1980s, a lot of psychiatry departments were run by psychoanalysts. And that made perfect sense because psychoanalysis contributed a tremendous amount in changing our culture and understanding the mind. But starting in the 80s, we began to be more biological, and the biologists kind of took over. And that's when I was doing my residency and chief residency at on Long Island in a large county hospital. And since then, we've been focused almost exclusively on the biological processes underlying mental illnesses and the psychopharmacology that we use to treat them. The problem is we don't know enough, really, about what we're treating. We sit in psychiatric offices treating patients we don't understand, with medications we don't fully understand, to patients who don't really understand that they have an illness. And all that contributes to a certain degree of subjectivity in our diagnosis. You know, I've said in my book that psychiatry is kind of in the dark ages. You know, if you go to any other specialty, you sit down, you tell the doctor your symptoms, he examines you, he performs some tests, and he comes back at some point and says, well, you've got diabetes, you've got high blood pressure, you've got heart disease, whatever. In psychiatry, we don't have a single blood test or x-ray to give us a diagnosis. So we rely entirely on what the patient tells us, a history from the family sometimes, and a history of prior treatments. And there's too much subjectivity in that. Furthermore, our medications, which do work, we help a lot of people, are very idiosyncratic. And what helps one person is totally ineffective with another. So we're still groping to find medications that will work with almost everyone. Usually we have to pull together combinations of medications, and we need better medications with fewer side effects that work quicker. Hmm. So that's kind of a capsule summary of what's been going on in psychiatry.
Right. I remember interviewing a psychiatrist on this program some years ago, and the moment I remember most vividly is when the point was made that in an astonishing number of cases, medication that is given for mental illness might be effective, but to some extent, the reason it's effective or exactly why it does what it does is not fully understood. And I just sort of found that kind of shocking and also disconcerting to think that medications are being prescribed in which we might not really have a complete grasp of their efficacy and why exactly they accomplish the good that they undeniably do. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah. And the reason is that we don't fully understand what mental illness is, including schizophrenia. And I'm hoping that my book will make a significant dent in changing that. You know, if you're not fully understanding what you're treating, how can you do research on it? How can you create medications to help? We do know some of the biological underpinnings of mental illness and the neurotransmitter deficits and changes that occur, but we don't have an overview, really, of what mental illness is. And I hope to provide that with my theory and Footprints of Schizophrenia.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Stephen Lesk, author of a book called Footprints of Schizophrenia, The Evolutionary Roots of Mental Illness, a book published by Prometheus. And before we dig into your very interesting theory, we probably should talk for a moment about what schizophrenia itself is. I mentioned in the introduction that, at least according to your book, some 20 million people all around the world suffer from schizophrenia. And I remember from elsewhere in your book, you saying something to the effect that schizophrenia crosses, in a sense, all ethnic, racial, economic, societal groupings. I mean, it would seem that anybody and everybody is vulnerable to suffering from schizophrenia. It is not a disease of the rich or a disease of the poor or a disease of a certain hemisphere, but it is just a widespread human affliction. Tell us more about that.
Well, that's what they call the anthropoparity principle, that schizophrenia is 1% of the population worldwide across all geopolitical, socioeconomic, and ethnic boundaries. And that is not typical of genetic illnesses. Look, for example, at sickle cell anemia, which tends to focus on black people. Ashkenazi Jews are more susceptible to Tay-Sachs. So this implies that something else is going on other than genetics. And that was one tip-off to me, that we had to look elsewhere than just trying to find the schizophrenia gene. We've been searching for a schizophrenia gene for decades, but never found it. Two people with identical genes, identical twins, if one has schizophrenia and it's a genetic illness, you'd think 100% of the time the other one would. But it's less than 50%. And Darwin has told us that any mutation that reduces your functionality and ability to procreate will rapidly become extinct. Well, schizophrenia is showing no signs of extinction. So all of that leads me to think that we're looking in the wrong direction when we're focusing on genetics. Mm.
Before we delve into your theory, let's talk for a moment about exactly what, to whatever extent we can say, exactly what schizophrenia is. It sounds like schizophrenia is something that is not particularly easy to pin down, in that it can manifest itself in a number of different ways. At least summarize for us, first of all, kind of the essence of what all people with schizophrenia sort of share in common, but then sort of the length and breadth of the different ways in which schizophrenia is experienced.
Well, imagine this. You're going through high school pretty well. You've got a group of friends. You're academically okay, or maybe even better than okay. And suddenly around the age of 18, you know, end of high school, people start treating you differently. They act as if you're saying very strange things and behaving strangely. And the truth is they've noticed that things are different for you, but you yourself really haven't noticed anything. But what they may start hearing are things like, well, voices are coming from the vents, person may experience other types of hallucinations and visual hallucinations. They may believe the government is following them. Paranoia is a very common symptom, delusional thinking of all types. And that makes it, you know, a very different experience for each person. But the universality is that the person's thinking has changed, and everyone around them notices it. They become more withdrawn from their peers, less concerned about personal appearance. They start to do strange things and say strange things. And this happens usually toward the end of high school, beginning of college. And if they don't get brought in for evaluation, it can go on for quite a long time before anyone says that they need treatment. And there are some research studies that show that the longer you go untreated with schizophrenia, the worse the prognosis. And once you have the illness, you're stuck with it for a lifetime, and you'll need to be on medication for a lifetime. And basically your functional expectations may go down, usually do go down. You may not marry, you may not hold a job, you may have to live in a supportive group home. But generally, things are less in terms of your functional expectations.
How wide a range are we talking about in terms of severity of schizophrenia? I mean, what would be its most mild manifestation versus its severest?
Well, there is a wide range of severity among schizophrenics. Now, the average schizophrenic, as I said, will be less functional after the diagnosis than prior to the diagnosis. But there's also a group of what they call high-functioning schizophrenics. If you saw the movie A Beautiful Mind, that was about Jonathan Nash, who won a Nobel Prize. The author, Ellen Sachs, who went to Oxford and Yale and became a lawyer, described her repeated bouts with psychosis and schizophrenia. Weijin Wang, who wrote a book that collected schizophrenia, it was on the bestseller list for months. He's clearly schizophrenic, but an excellent writer. Bethany Yeiser, who wrote a book, Mind Estranged, was in college when her schizophrenia set in, and within a few months she was living couple of blocks from her university on a church stoop, homeless and overtly psychotic. So these are things that happen to people that tend to reduce their functionality. So imagine that your thinking has changed. You believe in things that other people don't see as realistic. You may be hearing voices that are usually very pejorative, you know, telling you to harm yourself. It's going to be very hard to function in our modern society.
One of the things you describe in your book is this phenomenon where someone with schizophrenia, some people who suffer from schizophrenia will have this fervent belief that the people in their lives to whom they are closest have somehow been replaced. I mean, that there are imposters. That's not really my mother. That's not really my father. That's not really my coach. I have heard of that before, but there's something especially vivid about your description of that, and it's really hard for me to imagine how terrible it would be to suffer from that kind of delusion, because, of course, at the heart of it then is a loss of trust in the people who maybe love you the most and care about you the most, and it just seems like when you lose that sense of connection with the people closest to you, that undermines so many other facets of the human experience and makes it almost impossible to move forward in any kind of way. I really appreciate how vividly you tell this really tragic story of schizophrenia.
Well, it's not a universal symptom for schizophrenics, but it's called Capgras syndrome, and they start to believe that the people closest to them have been replaced by doubles. And it could be their parents, their spouse, their therapist, whoever it might be. And of course, this breeds a tremendous amount of suspicion. It may even lead to assault of that person. Some schizophrenics will just flee their home because they are convinced that their loved ones have been replaced by doubles. And I think what's interesting about it is that it's kind of the inverse of what happens to families of schizophrenics. Around the age of 18, suddenly it looks like their family member has been replaced by someone else. It's really the same person whose cognitive functioning has changed to a more regressed type of thinking. And therefore, you know, their entire posture toward life has changed. And no one really has understood why up until now. I think my theory is the first fully complete and flushed out explanation of what schizophrenia really is.
We're speaking with Dr. Stephen Lesk about his book, Footprints of Schizophrenia, The Evolutionary Roots of Mental Illness. So one of the things you say in your book is this formulation of your theory really, in a sense, came out of a sense of both necessity and frustration that the field of psychiatry seemed to have so little in the way of solid explanations about where schizophrenia came from. Help us understand kind of the roots of your exploration as you first began trying to seek out more of kind of a tangible cause of schizophrenia. What kinds of things did you start thinking about or looking at? I mean, how did your examination of that crucial question begin?
Well, I was never satisfied with the explanations that I heard the attending psychiatrist give to families and patients. You know, family would come in and their son or daughter or uncle, whoever, had been diagnosed with schizophrenia. And of course, they'd ask the attending psychiatrist, well, what is schizophrenia? And I'd hear things like, well, it's a chemical imbalance, or it's genetics, or it's connectivity. Very superficial explanations. And over the decades of my practice, those really didn't change much. So kind of the dyed-in-the-wool nerd that I am, I thought, who better to come up with something deeper and clearer than that. So I started to broaden my knowledge base. I read some anthropology books, books about Darwinian evolution, books about language theory, and started to try to piece together an explanation that was much more satisfying. And part of this was an observation on my part that schizophrenic thinking doesn't just come out of nowhere. It's not a sudden chemical infused into their brain or like they took psychedelics. It's a regressive type of phenomenon. For example, I asked a patient once, why does the sun come up in the morning? Sometimes I like to just ask questions like that. And his answer was, tomorrow. So I sat there scratching my head and said, well, could you elaborate on that a little bit? So he said, well, didn't you see the play Annie? And suddenly burst into song, the sun will come up tomorrow. But this is typical of schizophrenic thinking. It's childlike thinking. It's regressive. It's not just a sudden faulty wiring in the brain. Schizophrenics have regressed to something previous, you know, both childlike and previous in terms of our evolutionary history. So that kind of clued me into looking at something from our past that might have been key in this process.
Before we progress, I want to bring up an interesting point in your book. You tell us that at one point in time, one commonly used term for schizophrenia, and I don't remember the original Latin, but it essentially translates, I think, as a new dementia or early dementia or something like that. And you're very careful to say that this actually is not that. I mean, maybe at a glance there are some similarities, but really what is happening in the mind of somebody with schizophrenia is not dementia. Could you just kind of point out that clarification for us, please?
Well, there was a psychiatrist named Kraepelin centuries ago, who called it dementia precox, which means early dementia. But we know now that there's a tremendous difference between schizophrenic thought and dementia. It's not a brain deterioration. It's a change in how they think and the rules of thought that they use. Just like children use different rules of thought than adults do. You know, a child may say, you know, the moon is a big fat man who will eat you. And, you know, kind of pat them on the head and say, that's cute. But they obviously are using different rules of thinking. And over the time of their development through childhood and adolescence, they adopt this adult way of thinking, which is much more realistic and universal communication, not just idiosyncratic. So clearly there's something going on that's regressive. Now, to complicate the picture, schizophrenics may suffer brain atrophy. And I have a theory about that in my book as well. Once the schizophrenic process sets in, they're no longer using the executive centers of their mind. And those centers may become sensorially deprived. You can compare it to a muscle. If you stop using a muscle, it will atrophy. The more you use it, it will expand. The mind is exactly the same. The more you use it, the more it expands. The less you use it, the more subject you are to atrophy. Now, since schizophrenics have regressed away from the adult centers of, you know, executive functioning, that part of the brain, the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, in essence becomes sensorily deprived and will start to atrophy, which is another reason that schizophrenics need to be medicated as soon as possible, because that can prevent that atrophy. So schizophrenia is not a dementia. They're not disoriented to time and date. They can do mathematics. They know how to tie their shoes and everything. But gradually over time, there may be some atrophy of their brain, which we try to prevent from medication.
So I guess what you're saying is dementia is, I suppose, at its heart, and the atrophying of the mind. And so this is sort of can be a secondary result of schizophrenia, that as a schizophrenic withdraws from the world, as is so often the case, that withdrawal and that elimination of mental stimulation then can lead to a kind of decline that in some way bears resemblance to dementia, but it's a mistake to equate schizophrenia with dementia. Is that sort of what you're saying?
Yeah, absolutely. Dementia is a structural deterioration of the brain. Schizophrenia is a functional change. And the thinking of a schizophrenic has gone back to a type of thinking that we used prior to language, and that children use, and that people who take psychedelics use, and that we all use when we're asleep. We use this more primitive type of thinking. But it's not a structural change initially. It may happen over time later. So that's why, you know, schizophrenia is very confusing. There are a lot of red herrings, one of which is genetics. But it's a disease that you have to kind of look carefully at to make sure you don't fall into one of these red herrings that have impeded us understanding it.
So the heart and soul of your theory about schizophrenia and its ultimate origins has to do with evolution and taking a very long view of where human beings came from, how we have developed over the millennia. Let me just say, before we plunge further, that you're very open in saying that, you know, that you are in some respects kind of a newcomer to this particular field. That is, when one trains as a psychiatrist, one is not also trained in the development of ancient man, at least not to a large extent, I should think. So you had to have, I should think, quite a learning curve in terms of understanding some of the finer points of evolution and its potential ramifications for what you were exploring. What was that like for you?
Well, I realized early on that I should expand my knowledge base. And the first thing I thought of was anthropology. And a lot of things in anthropology are kind of contested. But one thing that most anthropologists agree on is that language is the one thing that separates Homo sapiens from the rest of the animal kingdom. Now, what they call hominins, or human-like animals, have been around for millions of years, 6-7 million years. Language has been around for less than 50,000, which is a drop in the bucket in evolutionary terms. And language radically changed how we use our minds. It really changed everything about it. And we're still in this new crossover era. We haven't begun really to get through it. And some people are just not on board with it yet. And those people are the ones that we call mentally ill. So I had to do a lot of anthropological research to just get to this understanding of how different the recent 50,000 years of evolution have been for us. Now, once Homo sapiens got language, by 10,000 BC, we wiped out all the other species of Homo, Neanderthals, Denisovans, Nalini, all of them. We fanned out across the globe, and now we own the world. But that key ingredient was language, and it took some reading to understand that and get examples about it. And it came through pretty clearly over the readings that I do.
You spend quite a lot of time in your book exploring this very specific matter, and it's, in some respects, best for our listeners to explore that in its totality on their own, but at least summarize the dramatic ways beyond the obvious, or kind of beyond what most of us think about, in terms of the way in which the human experience changed so drastically, so radically, as we developed a capacity for language.
Oh, Well, before language, we were basically just large-brained animals. We couldn't participate in our thought processes. We were not at the top of the food chain. Humans were routinely eaten and destroyed by larger animals. We did not have much in the way of society or civilization. Once language set in, what it does is bring our thinking into a universal assessment of reality, what Troy called the reality principle. Prior to that, there was no way for the caveman to assess what was real or what wasn't, and to make very good decisions about it, because, like I said, they couldn't participate in their own thought process. So what happened once we got language is that our brains complexified and became much more organized and reality-based. And that gave us such a huge advantage that we were able to wipe out all the other species of Homo. And it also brought into focus civilization. Once we could think clearly and rationally evaluate things, we could come up with a social strategy that allowed us to cooperate. And we began to form civilizations. And with civilizations, we developed the institutions of higher learning, science, education, jurisprudence, you name it. Evolution certainly could endorse heartily civilization, because vulnerability to predators was much reduced. If you live in a village and the lion comes in, the villagers, you know, band together with their spears and sticks and kill it. But if you're out in the jungle alone, you're really at the whim of all kinds of predators. And civilization did another thing for us. You know, as animals, we have to expend a lot of energy trying to locate and kill and eat our food. In a civilization, we don't have to expend that energy. We just get in our electric cars, drive to the supermarket, and we find a chicken breast there wrapped in plastic. So, you know, everything about civilization was a plus, and it took language to complexify our minds enough that we could form civilizations and band together in that way.
Yeah, it's amazing to think about the way in which words, I mean, the power of speech allows us to band together, learn from each other, move forward. At one point you say, words performed their symphonic magic on our souls, weaving subtle complexities into our brains. You actually go so far in your book as to point out how the how gaining the power of speech actually changed the human brain and enlarged the brain, or enlarged one part of the brain in order to sort of create the capacity. And I think a lot of us amateurs on the sidelines might assume the opposite, that we got smarter, so we gained the ability of speech. And what you're kind of saying here, I think, is that we humans gained the capacity for speech, and that necessitated then the brain growing larger. Tell us more about the significance of that particular process.
Well, as we learn language, our brains enlarge on the left side, if you're right-handed, and that is to accommodate what language is. You know, over evolution, our brains did gradually increase from about 900 centimeters over millions of years to the current 1350 centimeters. But it reached kind of a plateau because the skull couldn't enlarge anymore because it wouldn't get out of the birth canal. So we were kind of trapped in this situation of expansion that reached a plateau, and more brain material was crammed into this skull size. But the mind was looking for something, you know, really drooling for something that could create an advancement, and that was language, especially for Homo sapiens, who were so adept at what we call symbol formation. Neanderthals actually had bigger brains than we did, but their voice box could not produce as many sounds as ours can. So they were limited there, and their language was much more primitive. But what language does is expand our minds, like I said, very analogous to a muscle. The more we use our minds with conscious thought, chemicals are secreted, like brain-derived neurotrophic factor, vascular endothelial growth factor, that literally expand our minds. If we stop thinking, our minds will shrink. So what happened was we gained this ability for conscious thought, universal communication, learning, writing, education, and this just changed everything about what our minds will become from childhood to adolescence.
So let's bring into the conversation this thing called dopamine, because this is really central to your theory about what is happening in the mind and body of someone who succumbs to something like schizophrenia. First of all, explain what dopamine is and when in the course of human development it became sort of a different player in our human makeup. I mean, at what point did the place of dopamine in the typical human being's life changed drastically?
Well, I say in my book that once we got language, our relationship to dopamine changed considerably, and that there is some collateral damage from that, including a mental illness and some physical illnesses like Parkinson's, Tourette's, Huntington's chorea, possibly Alzheimer's. But dopamine is what we call a neurotransmitter. It's one of those little chemicals that go back and forth between nerve cells and the synapse, which is the space between nerve cells. And dopamine was essentially evolution's handmade. And what I mean by that is evolution can only rule on mutations. You know, if a mutation increases your ability to survive, protect yourself, and procreate, it stays. And if it decreases your ability to survive, protect yourself, and procreate, rapidly goes extinct. But evolution has no effect on the day-to-day behavior of the caveman. And so evolution needed a chemical that would reward this kind of behavior that increased natural selection and survival of the fittest. So once you found a mate and were able to procreate, you get a dollop of dopamine. It's like a Pavlovian reward. Every time you do something like vanquishing a predator, finding food for your little family, etc., you get a dollop of dopamine. And we still do that. That still exists in our brains. Hmm. But what happened with language is that once we got conscious thought, we really didn't need an external reward to tell us whether our behavior was, you know, in our best interest or not. And we were able to suppress dopamine in tracts of the brain that we were never able to suppress it before. There are four main dopamine tracts. Now, one of them, the nigrus striatum, has to do entirely with movement. And as we learn coordinated movement, you know, in childhood to adolescence, we suppress dopamine in that tract to bring it into a line with another neurotransmitter called acetylcholine. So this idea of dopamine suppression was already there in that tract, but it wasn't until we got language that we could start suppressing dopamine in these other tracts, and that made all the difference. Because when you suppress dopamine, you intensify your ego, you intensify your ability to gate out unwanted ideas and impulses, you expand the brain, like I said, with chemicals like BDNF, EEGF, and you're able to entertain a universal communication with your peers. So all of this sprang from the suppression of dopamine. Again, this is my theory. Not anyone else necessarily will tell you that, but I think it's pretty obvious that this must have taken place, because every single mental illness that we know of is a result of the desuppression or surge of dopamine. And every medication we use to treat mental illness blocks or suppresses dopamine in some way. So I'm pretty sure that this is what happened evolutionarily with dopamine.
So your contention is then that the typical schizophrenic, in your words, has regressed to a time before language. And that would be to a time then when, in a sense, dopamine reigned supreme, when dopamine would be sort of the primary sort of driving force in a given person's life and behavior and decisions and so on. So you are suggesting that someone suffering from schizophrenia is being taken back to, in a sense, an earlier version of human, in which dopamine is no longer suppressed. Do you have any theories about what the trigger for this might be? Or, I mean, if something in particular in the brain is going on that would lead to this de-suppression of dopamine?
Well, my theory states that schizophrenia is the only reason it exists is that we're in this evolutionary moment in which not everyone is on board with the dopamine suppression equally. And those who are less on board with it are ones who become mentally ill. Now, as we go from childhood to adolescence, we're in a process of language development and learning and education, and all of this fosters dopamine suppression. But once we reach a plateau and have learned to speak appropriately and realistically, there's kind of a moment, a window of opportunity for dopamine to de-suppress. Now imagine that our minds worked one way for 6 million years, and our minds have worked this new modern way for only 50,000. I like to use the analogy that you take 3 yardsticks, lay them end to end, each one representing 2 million years, so that's 6 million. Language has been around for less than the last inch. So this is brand new, and the momentum is certainly with the old way of using our minds. And like I said, we all use that, what I call primitive organization, when we're sleeping. But for schizophrenics, around the age of 18, they've stopped learning language, they mastered it very well, there's a window of opportunity, and suddenly there's a huge surge of dopamine that I call desuppression, and they're thrust back to this type of mind that we had prior to language. Now, of course, they can still speak, and they're able to express things, but what they express is using different rules of thought than the modern adult does, just as the child expresses things, it uses a different rule of thought. So in essence, this primitive organization has recaptured the mind, and it accompanies a surge or desuppression of dopamine. And every single chemical that we use to try to help schizophrenics blocks dopamine.
As you say, I think so tellingly at one point in your book, the barge of evolution is making its creaky course correction, but it is still doing so. So in other words, we are still in the midst of this shift, and it is your contention that this is what explains why there are some people among us who, you know, in a sense are not in the same place and are subject to or vulnerable to this desuppression of dopamine, with the results being something like schizophrenia and other disorders. In our last couple of minutes, I wonder if you could just say a word about what you at least imagine the real-world implications might be of your theory. That is, if in fact this proves to be true, that this is sort of the source of schizophrenia, do you imagine that that then in turn can lead to significant breakthroughs in terms of how we deal with and treat schizophrenia?
Well, I'm hoping so. You can't really treat something you don't understand. So understanding should bring better research, better treatments, less stigma. I'm hoping that this will reduce stigma. So it's purely a result of this new evolutionary moment that we're in, this radical change in how we use our minds. And it makes perfect sense that not everyone is on board with it yet. I made the prediction that maybe 5,000, 10,000 years from now, there will be no mental illness, because we will have gotten through this evolutionary moment and everyone will be on board with it, and we won't be seeing people suffering from this type of reaction, regressive reaction, where the primitive organization takes over again. And I believe that even happens partially with major depression, bipolar disorder, anxiety disorders, OCD. It's not as encompassing as with schizophrenia, but it's still the same principle of dopamine desuppression and regression away from conscious thought. Conscious thought is one proven way to suppress dopamine. So we're in this era that I think we will pass through, but not for thousands of years. In the meantime, we have to understand that, and we have to start looking at that in terms of our research efforts and giving up on this idea that it's purely genetic. It's much more than that. It's evolutionary. If it were purely genetic, schizophrenia would be extinct.
Well, you can learn much more from this intriguing book titled Footprints of Schizophrenia, The Evolutionary Roots of Mental Illness, published by Prometheus, and the author, Dr. Stephen Lesk. Dr. Lesk, I really appreciate you joining me today on the morning show to talk about your fascinating book. Thank you so much, and best wishes to you.
Thanks a lot for the opportunity.
This weekend on the podcast version of The Morning Show, we will be finishing up what has been, in a sense, a tribute to Nan Calvert, who for the last 18 years helped to coordinate and co-host monthly programs on various environmental themes. Nan recently decided to step down after all those years of faithful service to the station, and on the Saturday and Sunday podcasts of The Morning Show, we've been replaying some of our favorite conversations with Nan over the years. And you can tune in to the podcast tomorrow and Sunday to hear some favorite Nan Calvert conversations, including one about the Wisconsin State Botanical Club, and another a look at one of her favorite things, native plants. Next week in the broadcast of The Morning Show on Monday, we will be talking about Alzheimer's with Susan Johnson and Paula Clark from the Kenosha County ADRC, the Aging and Disability Resource Center, where Susan Johnson is the dementia care specialist and Paula Clark is program's supervisor. On Tuesday, a music faculty colleague from Carthage will be joining us, Dr. James Ripley, to talk about a wonderful concert planned for Wednesday evening, February 28th, which seeks to recreate as much as possible the very first band concerts that occurred on the campus of Carthage College 150 years ago. On Wednesday, we'll be hearing about the latest play at the